from Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College,
this is...
This is...
This is...
This is War News Radio.
I'm Madeline Abramowitz.
And I'm Cyrus Stoller.
Our treasure is our museum, and our fortune is our museum. Our home, which is this museum, is violated. We feel so sorry about that. So sorry.
This week on War News Radio, Rebuilding History, we find out about the international effort to restore Iraq's National Museum, which was looted during the invasion.
Then, we hear from a UN worker about her time in Kabul.
We're not allowed to walk. I would love to walk to work. There's one thing I'd love to do is walk around here.
And we speak with a few military families who are against the war in Afghanistan.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
The Afghan Independent Electoral Commission announced this week that there will be a presidential runoff election. The decision comes after nearly 2 months of fraud investigations by the UN-backed Electoral Complaints Commission. The current tally gives President Hamid Karzai approximately 48% of the vote, down from his initial 54%, while challenger Abdullah Abdullah won 31%, up from 28%. Since neither candidate took a majority, Afghanistan's constitution requires a second round of voting. President Karzai accepted the decision under pressure from high-ranking Western officials. The runoff is scheduled for November 7th.
The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime released a report on the global impact of Afghanistan's poppy cultivation. The report estimates that opiates from Afghanistan kill 100,000 people annually, and that the Taliban makes more money now off of opium taxation than it did while it was in power a decade ago. The investigators also estimated that 12,000 tons of opium are unaccounted for, enough to meet world demand for 2 years.
The Pakistani army has begun an assault on South Waziristan in an effort to regain control of the Afghan border. South Waziristan is part of the federally administered tribal area, which has long been a stronghold of the Pakistani Taliban. Pakistan has steadily lost control of the region in recent years, and the outcome of the operation is seen as a test of the government's strength. The offensive has led to fears of a refugee crisis, and an estimated 260,000 civilians are expected to flee the fighting.
A series of attacks shook northern Iraq this week. In Mosul, the body of a murdered police officer was dumped in his parents' home. In the same area, a U.S. soldier was killed, and two people were wounded by an IED. A car bombing in Kirkuk killed an Iraqi cameraman and wounded a journalist. In the west, another car bombing killed 4 and wounded 11 north of Fallujah. Among the dead were 3 police officers.
The Iraqi parliament has once again failed to approve regulations for the country's January parliamentary elections. The delay means that legislators are running up against a tight deadline. The head of the election commission said that the elections will have to be rescheduled if a law is not passed by next week. The main disagreement was over the allotment of votes in the city of Kirkuk. That city's oil resources and ethnically mixed population make its status a major point of disagreement. The timing of the parliamentary elections is a concern for American policymakers, since the troop withdrawal is expected to begin only once the new parliament convenes.
A delegation of Iraqi officials came to Washington, D.C. this week for a conference promoting American investment in reconstruction. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki both made keynote speeches touting new investment opportunities. The Iraqi Finance Ministry has estimated that $400 billion of investment are needed to rebuild the country. But many potential investors have expressed concerns about corruption, violence, and legal issues that could threaten business.
President Obama has signed a bill meant to ensure that the Department of Veterans Affairs has steady funding for veteran health care. The Veterans Health Care Budget Reform and Transparency Act allows Congress to allot funding for medical programs a year in advance. Funding for veteran health care has suffered in the past as a result of budget uncertainty.
This is War News Radio. The looting of Iraq's treasured National Museum during the first weeks of the American invasion has become a symbol of the chaos that engulfed Baghdad. But in the years since, international groups have combined forces with Iraqis to restore the country's cultural treasures. Claire Cobesa and Sam Hirschman have the story. Here's Claire.
Most people have heard about Mesopotamia, the cradle of civilization. But with the focus on the war in Iraq, and before that, the violence of Saddam Hussein's regime, Iraq's cultural history is sometimes lost. Roger Matthews, chairman of the British Institute for the Study of Iraq.
So if one thinks about things such as the origins of settled life 10,000, 12,000 years ago or so, the origins of farming, animal domestication, plant domestication, the world's first cities, the world's first writing from about 3,200 BC, the first empires, all these events which have a global human significance really took shape in Iraq.
Hundreds of thousands of Iraq's ancient treasures are preserved at the Iraq National Museum in Baghdad. But in the first month of the American invasion in 2003, rampant looting robbed the museum of some of its collection. About 15,000 antiquities were stolen. Among them, the 5,200-year-old mask of Warka, described as the Sumerian Mona Lisa. Modern artist Qais al-Sindi, who was living in Baghdad at the time, remembers how upset he felt when he heard about the lootings.
Our treasure is our museum, and our fortune is our museum. That's why all the people are feeling with much of bitterness and disappointed when our museums was looted, because those valuable treasures that we have in this museum refer to us. Our home, which is this museum, is violated. We feel so sorry about that. So sorry.
The tragedy was even more deeply felt by those who dedicated their lives to the museum. Donnie George was director of the Iraq Museum for the first 2 years of the war.
Everything can be rebuilt. Everything can be bought with money, but not the museum. Once a piece is lost, then it's gone. You cannot buy it. You cannot find it in the market. So this was a great loss for everybody.
George says that a few Iraqis were so concerned about the museum's collection that they took matters into their own hands.
Two young men came to me and said, "Do not ask us about our names or addresses, whatever, but rely on our word of honor. We were here during the looting time. We wanted to stop the people. We could not, because they were by hundreds and they were all armed. So we decided to take some of the material with us, hide it in our place, and when we will see that the museum is very well protected, we'll bring them back."
They did show up.
After we had the American forces protecting the museum, one of the staff came to me, said, "Donnie, there are people outside, they want to bring antiquities back to the museum." When I went out there, it was those two young men in a minivan. They brought 9 very important pieces that they have taken from the galleries of the museum and brought them back to the museum.
A team of U.S. Marines working with Iraqis managed to find and bring back about a third of the stolen artifacts. The other 2/3 are still missing. And even with some of its collection returned, the museum is still on a long road to reopening. They've had to repair their damaged building and archaeological labs and train new staff as well. The international community has stepped in to help. UNESCO, the UN agency in charge of preserving cultural heritage, has received donations from all over the world to help fund the rebuilding of the museum. Scholars from the United States, England, France, Italy, and elsewhere have also been involved. Roger Matthews says the level of interest and cooperation is not surprising. Iraqi scholars and archaeologists have a long history of collaboration with foreign colleagues.
Well, Iraqis are very proud of, quite rightly, of course, proud of their archaeological and historical heritage, and have a long tradition of being involved with that, being engaged with that, both themselves, but also in collaborative projects with non-Iraqis, with foreigners.
Gil Stein, director of the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, was one of the foreign scholars helping the Iraqi National Museum get back on its feet. The Oriental Institute's program and others like it bring Iraqis to the U.S. or other countries and train them in English and antiquities conservation. This training allows them to go back to Iraq and participate in the cultural rebuilding, both as scholars and conservators.
And the idea is we want to create a nucleus of trained people who are Iraqis, who work for the government, who can then train others and really form the heart of rebuilding the professional infrastructure of people who care about cultural heritage and have the training to really make major contributions.
Though rebuilding has progressed as more artifacts are returned and working spaces such as the lab are restored, there is still a long way to go. Donnie George, former director of the National Museum, expresses concern about its reopening.
With the current situation of the security in the country, I believe it's still not the time to reopen the museum, because any museum is a very soft target. The visitors there would be families, children, students, normal visitors. You cannot expect a place to be a place of culture that you put it in jeopardy, that someone with this situation going on will come in and blow himself inside the museum and kill these innocent people and destroy this cultural heritage.
When it is safe for the museum to reopen, Iraqis will be able to visit and learn about their culture, as Qais al-Sindi says they used to do.
Before the war, during Saddam era period, yes, the people were so interested to go to see the museums and art galleries and attend also the concerts. But now, no, because the people are so busy in their critical life, in their chaotic life, you know. It's missing of security there. Many things are not available, like electricity or a good transportation. Many things are not good now. The life now is so chaotic in Iraq. That's why the people there will not ask for luxury facilities like the art or the music. They want just food, just to survive there.
Many people would like to see Iraq's cultural life revived. Donnie George.
I would love to have this Iraq Museum reopened and inviting people from all over the world, especially scholars and friends who had supported the Iraq Museum after this tragedy of 2003, to come and witness the reopen of this one of the most important museums in the world in Baghdad. But, I hope I will see that day in my life.
For that day to come, more work will be needed, both from invested Iraqis and the international community. Gil Stein says protecting these resources is not a choice, but an obligation.
It's not just an Iraqi problem. It's part of our own history that we have an obligation to protect. You wouldn't want to burn up all the photo albums for the last 100 years of your own family, because that's your history. And the ruins of Mesopotamia and the artifacts in the Baghdad Museum, they're the photo album of humankind.
With Sam Hirschman, I'm Claire Cobesa for War News Radio.
This is War News Radio. In Washington, the debate over increasing troop levels in Afghanistan goes on. But some who have loved ones at war are convinced that sending more troops would just mean more of the same. Sami Abbas spoke to members of Military Families Speak Out, an anti-war group for families with relatives in the military.
Paula Rogovin has been against war for a long time. Her father served as a medic in World War II and saw the terrible cost of the war. For as long as she can remember, her family has been active in the peace movement, so she was surprised when her youngest son decided to join the Marines out of college. That's when she joined Military Families Speak Out, or MFSO.
He did go to boot camp and then joined the Marines. He's been to Iraq twice. And I know that when there's a crisis in my life, I need support and I need to be working with other people.
Military Families Speak Out is an organization for people who are opposed to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and have relatives serving in the military. It has over 3,400 members, both in this country and others. And as U.S. troops face big changes like redeployment and extended tours, their families back home are fighting their own battle, not to be invisible in their efforts to end the wars.
So many people don't even realize that we're still at war, that it's still going on, that we're losing people every day, all the time. But of course, the people of Afghanistan know that, and the people of Iraq know that. But Americans don't.
Anna Berlinroot is a New Jersey member of Military Families Speak Out. Berlinroot's son is a Marine reservist and joined when he was 18 years old. He's been deployed to Iraq three times since the 2003 U.S. invasion and just returned to the U.S. in April. Her family has served in the military dating back to the Civil War, and she believes in a strong military for this country. But with militaristic might, she says, comes greater responsibility.
Having a strong military is a huge responsibility. Just because we have it doesn't mean that we should be using it on a whim. And that's what I think the Bush administration did in Iraq, especially.
When America first went into Afghanistan, Anna Berlinroot said she supported the effort. She wanted bin Laden out. But as the government's reasoning became more and more skewed, her perceptions changed. Sarah Furo, an MFSO member from Massachusetts, agrees and emphasizes the high cost of the wars.
I see other families whose husbands or wives or sons or daughters come back after being directly involved in combat, and they pay a terrible price in their psyches and their hearts and their souls.
Furo's son has been deployed twice and is currently in Afghanistan. He's a mental health worker and teaches medical techniques to Afghan civilians and soldiers. But even as she supports what her son is doing, she's been against these wars from the beginning. She says the Afghanistan incursion is not only unnecessary, it's useless.
To plunk all those people who have been deployed two or three times to Afghanistan and Iraq and take them like chess pieces and then stick them in Afghanistan like, oh, and now we'll do kind of Afghanistan, when there's no military answer in Afghanistan, there just isn't. And anybody who knows anything about it says the same thing.
And according to Anna Berlinroot, the repeated deployments are not only hard on the troops themselves, they create pressures back home.
It's just weakening our whole military family structure to have our loved ones away for so very long. And then when they come back, they're just not the same people they had been. And then to have to face another deployment, it's just terrific.
Another Military Family Speak Out member, Linda Engelund, a resident of Chicago, has a son serving his second deployment in Iraq. She says the return of veterans poses its own challenges, too.
I mean, it's almost worse when they get out, when they try to access anything that they're entitled to with the VA, with the health system, and with the benefit system.
Members of the military may have to wait years to receive benefits. Only a few years ago, the backlog of claims at the Department of Veterans Affairs was 600,000. Now it's over 1 million. And in the meantime, they have to figure out how to live, get jobs, and support families. When Anna Berlinroot's son couldn't find a job, he ended up reenlisting with the Marines for another 3 years.
He's now married, and he has a 7-month-old child. So the baby was born while he was away, and he needs to help support his family. He may have to be full-time and have another deployment again soon.
No matter their backgrounds and histories, these mothers are fed up with the wars. Wars they feel are useless and far more costly than beneficial.
Most Americans don't have anyone within their families with boots on the ground. So therefore, they're just not aware of what is really happening to military families. They're told that, well, these people volunteered. But when you volunteer to any other organization, you can quit when you want. You can't just quit and walk out of the military, unfortunately.
Linda Engelund is worried about where Military Families Speak Out will fit in as the U.S. moves further into Afghanistan and as Americans continue to lose touch.
I think the organization is really struggling to find its place in this new political scenario, and that in many ways I just feel like we've just been passed by. We go to war in a country and we stay there forever, or for 100 years or 60 years or whatever, and it just becomes so common we don't even question it.
But these mothers of Military Families Speak Out will continue to fight, because to them, it's the only war that will make a difference. For War News Radio, I'm Samia Abbas.
This is War News Radio. The United Nations mission to Afghanistan employs 1,500 staff, around 300 of whom are foreign nationals. Emily Hager spoke with one Canadian who worked in Kabul for 3 years about the changes she's experienced both in her life and the city around her. This piece first aired in February. Here's Emily.
Nancy Butera ended up in Kabul almost on a whim. She had been working on administrative tasks for the UN in Vienna for about 5 years when she decided to try something new and take a mission to Sierra Leone in Africa. It was there that she heard about all the job openings in Kabul.
I was actually stationed in Sierra Leone where it's very hot and humid. I had to come to Kabul where it was much cooler, and of course the dress code here is much different. So I spent 1 week in Vienna basically shopping for anything I could find that was long-sleeved and things I could cover up with.
She made the transition from working in Sierra Leone to working in Kabul for the UN there in 2 weeks flat.
I flew in at night, and the only thing I really saw was just lights. So it wasn't until the next day I got my real impression of the place. And I was just, I think, more shocked by the lack of green. There's a lot of mountains around Kabul, but all of them are completely bare of trees or anything like that. But in a way, it's kind of attractive.
Nancy had never been to Central Asia, so when she decided to come to Kabul, she was more worried about culture shock than about the security situation. But on her first night, violence rocked the city.
The first day I arrived, there was actually a bomb explosion, one of the first really big bombs that started this spree of suicide bombings back in 2005. And although it wasn't anywhere near where we lived or anything, we were basically told it was White City. And White City is when basically they shut down the international movement in the city. So you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything, you have to stay put where you are. So my first 2 weeks here, I was basically locked up in my room.
Nancy's job was with the UN Office of Procurement Services. She lived in a guest house with 10 fellow UN ops workers. UN vehicles would come and pick them up every morning, drive them to work, and then come back at the end of the day to take them home. Strict UN rules regulate where she and her coworkers can live and how they can travel. For instance, their houses have to have 2 security guards, one inside the building and another outside. They have to check in over the radio each night, and they have to obey the curfew, 11 p.m. At times, she finds following these rules frustrating, but if she doesn't, she'll risk losing her job.
We're not allowed to walk. I would love to walk to work. There's one thing I'd love to do is walk around here.
All these regulations, the secure housing, the white UN-marked vehicles, the curfew and the radio check, they're all designed to keep the people who are working for the UN in Kabul safe. But they also kept Nancy from going out and experiencing life in the rest of the country. As it was, she had to content herself mostly with the view out the windows of the vans and conversations with Afghans she met at work. On the other side of the glass, the streets of Kabul were bustling.
There's a lot of people walking around on the streets. You'd see a lot of, you know, people carrying their things in the morning to the market to sell. It's very common to see also people begging on the street.
But less than a month into her first job in Kabul, Nancy met someone who would change her life. He was an Afghan working in another division of the UN project.
He was working in finance, so I was seeing him every day because I was harassing him with, you know, bills to pay, things like that. And we kept in touch. And we were chatting online with Messenger, Skype, and then he would drop by and meet me for lunch, that kind of thing.
They went for walks around the block and out to dinner at UN-sanctioned international restaurants in Kabul. And less than a year after she had arrived in Kabul, on Valentine's Day, another surprise.
He actually proposed to me in the first year I met him. I was actually very on guard because having worked internationally before, I know that there's also a lot of people who are trying to get visas or trying to, you know, this kind of thing. And I was very, I with him, not to mess around with my head or anything like that, because I wasn't interested in looking for a visa or whatever. I was actually too blunt, and we're both very nervous, myself because my family wouldn't, I didn't think, ever understand, that they would think I was nuts, and himself because of the cultural situation here. I mean, his family would want him to, of course, have an arranged marriage of some sort.
But she accepted. Nancy flew home to Canada to tell her parents she was getting married. On her way back to Kabul, she and her husband met up in Pakistan. They were married in Peshawar at his sister-in-law's house. It was only the second time Nancy had met any of her new husband's family. She didn't meet her parents-in-law until she got back to Kabul. To her relief, she and her Afghan in-laws get along well, despite the language barrier.
It's a really hard language to pick up. Dari is much easier to pick up than Pashto. My husband's family is Pashtun, and I just don't understand anything they say. And they think it's rather funny that I've been here for 2 years and I haven't learned anything, because I kept promising that I would try to get a teacher or a tutor. And because my job is so busy and you're surrounded by English-speaking people all day, every day, it's really hard to pick up the language.
Nancy gave birth to a healthy daughter in the spring of 2006. Now she's 20 months old, growing up. I spoke with Nancy on one of her last mornings in Kabul. She and her daughter are leaving for Canada soon. She says it's not because of the security situation, though she does notice that security is getting worse. There have been more frequent attacks, and in response, more heavy-duty barricades are sprouting up around the embassies in Kabul. She's willing to stick it out. In fact, she hardly notices the difference until she talks with her friends who've just arrived in Kabul. But her daughter is getting old enough that Nancy feels she has to move. She wants her daughter to have access to parks, playmates, and a good education. It was a tough call.
It's kind of hard to go to a place, work there and that, and then leave, and then you don't have any kind of memories of as much of the culture as you might want. Fortunately, I mean, I met my husband here, so I have a lot more than other people. But, for example, I've been invited to many Afghan weddings, and because of the security regulations for my contract, I can't go to them. So, I mean, some people do sneak out and go to these kind of things, but I've always been too kind of worried to do that.
For now, her husband will be staying in Kabul. They haven't been able to obtain a visa for him to join the family in Canada.
It's been over a year now, a year and 2 months, and we're still waiting for an answer. So we're keeping our fingers crossed. We're hoping that our case is finally coming to an end. Our last contact with them was in early January.
Nancy and her family hope they'll be reunited soon in Canada. But she says she's not abandoning Kabul, the city where, for the past 3 years, she's found both love and frustration. She'll be back, sooner rather than later. For War News Radio, I'm Emily Hager.
That's our show for this week.
War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College.
Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
On our site, you can also comment on this show or on our past programs.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Anjali Kadambi, Emily Dolson, Kyle Gechner-Wald, Alan Zhao, Jenna Zhu, and Abdullah Mizyad. I'm Madeline Abramowitz.
And I'm Cyrus Stoller. Until next time. Thanks for listening.